Chandikai. Om Namah Chandikai. Om Namah Chandikai. Jayanti Mangala Kali Badrakali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadhanamostute Jayatvam Devi Chamande Jaya Bhutartiharini Jaya Sarvagate Devi Kalaratri Namostute Madhukaitava Vidravi Vidatri Varade Namaha Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Mahishasura Nirnashi Bhaktanam Sukade Namaha Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Shambhasya Eva Shambhasya Dhumrakshasya Chama Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Natebhyaha Sarvadha Bhaktya Chandike Durita Pahe Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Dehi Sobhagyam Arogyam Dehi Me Paramasukam Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Videhi Devi Kalyanam Videhi Paramam Shriyam Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Himachala Sudanat Samstute Parameshwari Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Indrani Pati Sabhavam Pujite Parameshwari Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Devi Prachanda Daradanda Daitya Darpa Vinashini Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi
Good evening, good afternoon, and good morning to those of you who are in the early part of the day. I'm so delighted to be with you here and to be celebrating the first day of Navaratri, the Goddess Festival, with all of you. So before we begin, because there are quite a few people in this class who have not been in these sanghams before, I want to introduce Deb Buxton, who handles the logistics for the teleseminars, and she will be explaining some of the esoteric ins and outs of what we'll be doing over the next few weeks. So, Deb.
Hello, everyone. So I just wanted to highlight a couple things you can look for. We will be setting up the discussion list probably tomorrow morning. We use a system called Gaggle, so you want to make sure and watch for that welcome email. And please keep that welcome email for the duration of the course, because it will show you how to put yourself on digest, how to unsubscribe, and other good things in there. I normally have the audio available within 24 hours, so give me a chance to get them edited and up to the website before you start emailing me. But you're always welcome to look on the student portal, which you can access from your account at any time. If you've lost your password and you ask for a password reset, don't see the email come in your inbox, please check your spam folder, and then feel free, if you're still having troubles, to reach out directly to me at deb@sallykempton.com or admin. We send out two reminder emails. We send one out in the morning of class, and then we send out one 15 minutes beforehand. They both have a link and the dial-in instructions if you're dialing in. Then the other thing is, if you would like a partner to partner with the class, just send me an email with your preferred time zone, and I will start matching those up in the next couple of days. That's it. Otherwise, if you have technical issues, just please reach out to me.
Thank you, Deb. And those of you who've been working with her know she's incredibly, not just efficient, but also responsive to all these issues, if any come up. And I want to say, just to add one thing to what Deb said, that one of the really nice things to do in this class is to have a study partner. I will give weekly discussion topics that you can work with, either with a partner or alone journaling. But, you know, many of you, of course, have made friendships doing partner work with somebody, and it's really a wonderful way to kind of enhance your experience of the class. So welcome once again. It really does feel like a very strong day. A very good time to explore the nature of our inner and outer reality. And like many of you, I'm a lover of Shakti, the primordial cosmic power, the divine feminine, who is the heart of everything, the joyous energy that expresses herself through the seams of our lives. My main intention for us in this class is to explore the sadhana of personal liberation through cultivating our inner energy, our own deep inner energy, connecting it to its divine source, the primordial Shakti, and also, and maybe above all, by recognizing the play of energy, how Shakti operates in your body, in culture, and in the visible world. And in order to do this skillfully, in order to really track the energy that's playing within us and to make the most of it, to partner with it in the most productive way, it makes a huge difference. In fact, I've found that it's completely necessary to hold a vision of oneness, of wholeness, of non-duality, to connect the inner world to the cosmos at every level. That's what we'll be doing in this first class, just getting clear about the panoply, the framework through which Shakti becomes us. And we won't be doing the metaphysics in too much detail, but we'll be doing it in a little bit of detail just to clarify it for all of us and really set the frame. Sadhana, which we define as the practices that lead us to the truth, really is the most personal thing we can do. And for most of us, it's a lifelong process. We engage it at every level, inwardly in meditation, outwardly in our, in the movements of our lives. And there comes a point when we begin to realize that there is no moment in life that's not sadhana. But when we begin the process, and often for a long time afterwards, we're doing sadhana for the sake of being better, being happier, dissolving some of the trauma that blocks us from living a happy life, and we'll be doing some of that today, learning to take back our projections. But any inner work you do, whether it's clearing work or clarifying our motivations, transforming ourselves in all the ways we do, all of this deserves the name sadhana. Our sadhana is whatever we're doing to deepen our relationship to our inner being. But as we advance and as we deepen our practice, sadhana also becomes more directed towards the perception of what we might call truth. In other words, the perception of that which is actually not affected by trauma, by emotional ups and downs, or even by what's going on in the world. It becomes our effort to reunify ourselves with the divine reality, to dissolve our feeling of separation from the source of life. And, that doesn't mean, and especially because we're tantricas, that doesn't mean we ignore our life or that we ignore the practices that make life better or that we ignore social activism, but we see these from a different perspective. So instead of making them the goal of our practice, we realize more and more that the improvements we experience in life are actually side effects. They're gifts of the practice. And what that means is that through sadhana, even during the times when it's a roller coaster, which, of course, as most of you know, sadhana sometimes is, it is bringing our life into balance. And in fact, my experience is that one of the hidden upsides to the situation that we've been living through for the last year is that for many of us, it has actually allowed us to begin to cultivate the grace that lies within every situation, including really difficult ones. I've been finding, and I know many of you have been finding, that the intense upheavals, whether social or having to do with the pandemic or astrological, have actually been accelerating our practice, partly because practice is the best antidote to fear and anger, but also because it has become so necessary for our well-being to create a field of positive energy for ourselves and also so that we can offer our best to the world. And I know that some of you have taken bodhisattva vows, asking to live in the understanding that our practice is not just for us, but also for the sake of all beings. And even if we haven't officially made such a promise, I think most of us have begun to become aware of the effect that our own commitment to practice can have on the people in our lives and to the world around us. So my hope is that we will accelerate our connection to all that in us and in the cosmos that turns us towards the experience of our oneness with the divine source. The practices that we'll be doing in the next few weeks are based on some of the core truths of non-dual tantra yoga, which means that they aim at integrating the spiritual with the mundane, the mind with the heart, the subtle world with the world of the senses. And at the heart of tantra is an integrative recognition that in which we shift out of the feeling of being really a victim of forces beyond our control, whether they're people or collective events, so that all aspects of our life begin to appear as they really are, actually divinized. There's a wonderful phrase in some of the tantric texts that talks about the state of enlightenment as being the state where your vision is smeared. That's the translation. Your vision is smeared with the nectar of divine awareness so that you're seeing the world through that vision. And then our different states, the experiences of our senses and emotions, reveal themselves to be emanations, rays of the Spanda Shakti, the expansive energy that leaps up from the heart of reality. And this, to me, is really the greatest gift of Tantra. It's the ability it gives us to see our experience as divine. Utpaladeva, who's one of the great philosopher poets of medieval Kashmir, and one of the main philosophical sages of the Kashmir Shaiva tradition, wrote in one of his poems, "This is the path of Shiva, where poison turns to nectar and worldly life becomes the abode of liberation." So that's where we're at. And in the most radical forms of Tantra, nothing is left out. Nothing is excluded because everything is considered to be part of the single divine reality. And that doesn't mean that, you know, that we don't follow the rules of society or the rules of ethics. What it means is that we come to understand our experience and the vision that we have of our lives, not so much in terms of success or failure or ignorance or knowledge. Instead, we talk about contraction and expansion. Consciousness contracted, Shakti contracted, gives us the experience of duality, of us and them, of good and bad, of up and down, of happy and sad. Consciousness contracted is experienced as blocks in the flow of energy in our body mind. And many of you know about this because many of you do energy work. But you know, what we come to understand is that these blocks are not just physical. They're blocks in the inner body. And when these blocks are added together there, they create our suffering and collective suffering. But consciousness, as it expands, knows that not only are we connected inwardly and outwardly and connected to the world, but also that everything we experience through the mind and senses is actually an outflow, a play of Shakti, of divine energy. So this is the tantric attitude. And in my experience, no matter what stage of practice we're at, it's tremendously useful to hold this attitude. And it's tremendously useful to understand, to have an intellectual understanding of why we should hold this attitude, as well as a set of enlivened practices which actually make that a possibility. So part of this process of cultivating Shakti is to learn how to look at ourselves with an eye so radically loving that we can, that when we bring awareness to our own suffering, we can actually dissolve it. In this regard, we'll be working with key practices from the non-dual Hindu Tantra, particularly Kashmir Shaivism and Sri Vidya. We'll also be practicing with some meditations from the Buddhist Tantras. Many of them will be familiar to you, and some of them will be quite esoteric, because classical Tantra includes an enormous wealth of meditations, mantras, empowerments, rituals, and visualizations, all of which have one intention: to help you dissolve the false boundaries between your sense of self, your sense of personal self, and the sense of the pervading presence of the divine reality that holds all this. What you want to realize, and, you know, again, this is, you know, there's so much beautiful non-dual teaching in the world today. We want to hear it, we want to read about it, but most of all, we want to realize it. We want to realize that we're fractals of the absolute reality, that everything we think, do, and feel is an expansion of Shakti's dance. Here in this class, we're going to offer some of the basics of how we should understand Shakti from a non-dual perspective, their foundational teachings. We'll also be doing some traditional Navaratri practices honoring Goddess Durga, who is the deity of this festival, with storytelling, with mantra, with contemplative visualization. And we'll be practicing with our own body, with our breath, finding presence in our physical being. And this is really the foundational class. As we go on, we'll be working with practical ways for cultivating the transformative Shakti as feelings and sensations, as intuitions, as language, as mental attitudes, as kundalini, as visual symbols that shift our energetic field and connect us with the energy, the higher energies. We'll be studying some of the key verses in the Spandakarikas, the verses on vibration, and the Shiva Sutras, the aphorisms of Shiva, which are really the heart of how Tantrika understands Shakti. And we'll also be working with some of the great hymns of the tradition. So there's a lot. There's a lot that we'll be doing, a lot that we'll be experiencing, and a lot that we'll be coming to realize. Because, of course, one of the great gifts of Shakti, one of the great gifts of Sangha, is that it can kindle in a way that's much deeper than the intellect, our felt sense of what reality is. And that felt sense of reality will then transform every part of us. So we're going to begin with our primal gathering initiatory meditation. And you can find yourself, please, a comfortable upright posture, using the breath to settle yourself in the posture. I just want to take a moment to welcome those of you who are not listening to this live, but are listening to it tomorrow or the next day or weeks from now, and just want you to know that the power and the transmission in this class is fully present in the recording, and also to let you know that as you do the meditations, it's really good to sit down. You don't really want to do the meditations while sitting in the car. You want to do them in a comfortable seated posture in a way which will allow you to feel safe and undisturbed. So your posture is firm, and you're using the breath to draw your awareness deeper into the pelvic area. So with the inhalation, you feel that the breath comes into the belly and the sits bones and hips and thighs sink and become more deeply connected to your seat. And with the exhalation, you feel that the spinal column rises up through the crown. Your chest lifts and widens. Feel that your head rests in a very balanced way on your shoulders. focus for a moment on the gentle flow of the breath, not trying to change the breath, just being aware of it. Imagine now that we're seated together in a large, open-sided temple. There are many of us present here. And if you like, you can also invite some of your loved ones or friends who are not able to be physically present, but whom you would like to invite to this gathering. This temple is very beautifully decorated. There are flowers everywhere. There are lanterns. There are large paintings of goddesses. And around the temple are plants and trees and greenery and bushes filled with brightly colored flowers. And you can actually, if you're very subtly able, you can smell the fragrance of the flowers. In the center of the temple is a fire pit. We're seated around it. We're seated in circles around it. And the fire pit is quite elaborately decorated. The sides of it are painted red. The form, the frame of the pit is square, and in the middle of it is a circle which holds the fire. What we have gathered for is the opening of a great fire ritual in honor of the goddess, a ritual that is being performed all over India and in many places around the world, in which offerings are made to a sacred fire with mantras. And the mantras that are recited are the mantras of the Devi Saptashati, the Durga Saptashati, the Chandipat, the 700 verses in honor of the goddess Durga. What those of you who were here at the beginning of the class heard Krishnadas chanting some of those mantras. So we are here in the presence of the goddess who is being invoked in the fire. And as you sit before the fire, consider your intention for this time, for this celebration, for this very powerful and important moment in the flow of time. Navaratri is one of the great grace-bestowing festivals in the Hindu year. And it's one that anyone who tunes into it can begin to feel. It's a time of enormous blessing and enormous possibilities for opening begin to shower down on us. What intention do you want to bring to this? Perhaps you have many intentions. It's fine to have several. But just please take a moment to consider a wish, a sankalpa, an awakening desire that you would like to offer to the fire with the request that it be brought forth in your life. So feel now that you're holding in your hands a stick of sandalwood, very fragrant, beautiful wood, which is part of the offering that is customarily made to a sacred fire. And we're going to offer, each of us are going to offer one of those pieces of sacred wood into the fire with our intention. And as we prepare to do this, we're going to chant a mantra, which I will explain the meaning of later. The mantra is one of the great tantric Durga mantras. It goes, Om, Reem, Shreem, Dum, Durgaye Namaha. Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. This is our mantra for this evening. And I'm going to say it out loud a few times, and you can say it with me. Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. 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 And now as you say the mantra or think the mantra, offer your sandalwood to the fire with your intention. And if there's another intention that you'd like to offer, you can create another stick of sandalwood and offer that to the fire, saying to yourself, Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om, the sound of the infinite. Hrim, the sound of the goddess's power of manifesting worlds. Shrim, the mantra of supreme auspiciousness. Dum, the mantra that removes obstacles. All of it offered to the goddess Durga. And as you offer the sandalwood and the mantras, feel that in this gathering, in this moment, we're all receiving the gift of this brilliant fire of the goddess. And we'll chant the three main chants that we'll do to begin each class. Hopefully you have your mantras. And if not, you can listen or chant along. The first mantra comes from the Spandakarikas. It's the opening mantra of the Spandakarikas, the invocation that actually allows us to open to the knowledge of what Shakti is. The second mantra is a Gayatri mantra. It's one of the many Gayatri mantras that carries the grace of a particular form. And this one, which I particularly love, translation of it is, may we know her who enchants the universe. May we know, meditate on her in whom all beings take refuge. May Shakti bless us. May Shakti illuminate us, is actually the literal translation. The word Mohini refers to enchantment. It also refers to delusion or illusion, to the quality of Maya. And so these verses allow us to contemplate the fact that even within delusion or confusion, she lives, and we worship her even in that. And finally, we'll chant the mantras to the auspicious one, to Shakti as in her form as united with Shiva. And we can begin.
Yasyon mesha nimesha pyam jagata pralaya dayo tam shakti chakra vibhava Parabhavam Shankaram Stuma.
We praise Shankari Shakti, the source of the power of the circle of powers. When she opens and closes her eyes, this universe dissolves and arises.
Sarva mohinyai vidmahe vishva charanye dhimahi tano shakti prachodayat. Sarva mangala mangalye shive sarvatra sarike charanye triambake gauri Narayani namostute.
And we'll sing that one more time.
Sarva mangala mangalye shive sarvatra sarike sharanye triambake gauri Narayani namostute.
Your eyes are closed. In the presence of the fire, having the felt sense of the collective worship, the profound love that is being offered to the goddess on this night and that she offers back to us, begin to feel that with every inhalation, you draw in the spirit of Durga, the spirit of the great protective mother of the worlds, which emanates from the fire as a feeling of blissful warmth and flows into your body with the inhalation. And feel that as this light flows into your body, that you experience it as being filled with rainbow colors, red and blue, golden, white. And as you exhale, feel that this light flows through your body and out into the world. Every inhalation, drawing in the Shakti of Durga in the form of sweet, blissful, enlivening energy, and then every exhalation lets it flow through your body. We ask that through the power of our practice, all beings become free of suffering, that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. I know that most of us are very familiar with the idea of Shakti, with the concept of Shakti as cosmic creative energy. We know a lot about Shakti from our different studies, from our reading, and yet we often struggle to define Shakti in a way that conveys the fullness of her. You know, for instance, many people identify Shakti with being female, or at least female identified. With other people identify Shakti with sexual energy. And of course, the female body is a profound expression of Shakti, and sexual energy is one way we feel into our own Shakti. Others identify Shakti with awakened Kundalini energy, which is also a real expression of her. I tend to identify Shakti as the feeling aspect of the divine, and to often identify her with the sensations that go along with the felt experience of grace, of divine help, with answered prayers, with pulsations of softness that arise in meditation. So all these ways of seeing her are partially true. But to really understand Shakti, we actually have to relax into the recognition that everything we experience, including the physical world, including our thoughts, including our feelings, including every aspect of the culture, is made of Shakti. And this is something that is not that hard to get when we're in nature, for instance, when we can feel the life force in a forest or in the ocean. It's also very important to start to realize her in the subtlest forms that we can access, one of which is mantra, another of which is the more abstract quality that's both in mantra but is also everywhere, which is the quality of resonance, vibration. Some of you, and I don't want to open a can of worms here, but some of you, and this includes myself, when you when you close your eyes and turn inside, you hear a kind of resonance, kind of inner sound, which has many different forms. For some of us, it feels like a ringing in the ears. What it actually is the resonance of the Shakti that we begin to hear as a kind of hum or throb beneath and around all of our experience. So in that sense, we know that Shakti is awake in us often by our ability to hear this very subtle sound. Another, of course, of the ways that we approach Shakti is through the many forms of the feminine deities. And in fact, the word Shakti, when it's used to describe the cosmic creative energy, is often associated with goddess forms. And we will be doing some personal goddess practice. But we will also be practicing with her as in her vibrational nature as Spanda, the sacred pulsation, which is a more abstract, less personified way of understanding what Shakti is. But when we look at Spanda, it also helps us recognize her all-pervasiveness in quite a direct way. So the word Spanda means throb or pulsation, and it has the same root as the English word expand, or also the word spandex, which some of you are wearing now. It's got this stretchy quality to it. And it describes the energy at the heart of reality as an infinitely subtle tremor that is the life force that is actually shining in every particle of reality, including those aspects of reality that we don't normally think of as being alive. So Shakti resonates as especially, of course, as the life force, the prana, the chi, as well as the heartbeat, the rhythm of the breath, the flow of the seasons, the energy at a deeper level that evolves species and evolves consciousness, which is something we'll be discussing later on. So she's the laws of deep ecology. She's your biorhythms. She's the erotic drive for union and the desire for excellence. She's the zeitgeist, the flow of culture. And she's all the longings we experience, from hunger pangs to the desire for God. She's the ruler because she is all of it. In other words, she's so big, she's so all-pervading, and that to try to describe her in words is almost impossible. Though, of course, the poetic sages of many traditions have done their best. We'll be looking at her in the tantric way. We'll be using words to describe her in the tantric way, in which the intellectual aspect of language, while definitely present and significant, actually becomes less important than its vibrational effect on our consciousness. In other words, what I want to suggest is that the essence of what is being conveyed here, and I mean through my words, as well as through the mantras that we'll be practicing, is actually energetic. And because that's the case, because there is a powerful energy that she transmits, once we begin talking about her, she begins to show up for us. And one thing that sometimes happens in these classes is that you start going into meditation, which is the vibrational effect of what we're talking about here. So one of the reasons that I always suggest in these classes that you listen a couple of times, that even if you're here in person, that you also listen to the recording, partly because you'll hear a lot that you didn't hear, partly because, you know, if indeed you are having a deep meditational experience while I'm speaking, then you'll be able to actually get the sense of it later on. As I say, mantras are a very important part of this process. Many of the mantras that we'll be working with are bij mantras, or seed syllables, which do not have a specific definitional meaning, but which have a powerful energetic resonance that in tantric understanding is identical with the resonance of the goddess. In other words, these mantras, Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha, the mantras Om Hrim Shrim Dum, they signify energetic states, they signify powers, they even signify deity forms, but more than that, they connect us to the energy within these forms. And that energy takes root in us the way a seed takes root in the ground and begins to flower in us as spiritual experiences. So mantras are extremely, very much a part of what we'll be doing. So are the myths and the praise songs and some of the stories. So even though, as I said, this class is not about goddesses as such, we will be practicing this week with one of the goddess myths of the tradition, one of the myths that's associated with Navaratri. And we've also chosen to hold this class over a five-week period bracketed by the two great autumn goddess festivals. Tonight is the first night of Navaratri, as we've said, the nine-night festival to the goddess Durga. Next week, we'll also still be in Navaratri. Our final class will be held on Diwali, on the day sacred to the goddess Lakshmi. In these classes, we are actually going to be touching the three main popular forms of the Indian goddesses. Tonight is Durga, with her resonance, warriorship, and her Kali aspect, which destroys obstructions. Next week, we'll be practicing with Saraswati. And, of course, in our final week, we'll practice with Lakshmi. We begin with the goddess as the divine tiger mom, and we end with the form of goddess who represents all the wealth of the worlds. Let's just take a moment to turn inside and cultivate the mantra. We'll do it in a very, very briefly for this moment, and we'll keep returning to it. But what we really want to open to is this power in the mantra to give us darshan, to give us a sense of connectedness to the goddess. So you can close your eyes. Feel the breath. Sense it flowing into the heart and flowing out through the heart. And you can imagine that with the inhalation, that the mantra
Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha is flowing into the heart. And that with the exhalation, the mantra Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha flows through your whole chest area and brings warmth and energy to the whole area of your inner body. Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. So I want to talk a little, do a little comparative religion here. This is for my friend Patrick Mathey, who I've noticed is present tonight, and who is a professor of comparative religion, among other things. So Tantra belongs to a category of religious philosophy, which is often called panentheism, which holds that spirit both transcends the universe and also permeates it, penetrates it, has become it. Panentheism is theistic, meaning that the tantric tradition definitely recognizes a supreme being, a god figure. In fact, the Shiva Sutras, the foundational text of the tantric tradition, was transmitted, according to the legend, by Shiva himself, who wanted to point out to people who had fallen for the Buddhist tradition of no self, that there is a self and that that self is divine. So panentheism is theistic, but it's different from traditional religious theism, in which God is seen as a creator who's always apart from the world, transcending the world, and whom we can never become one with, who's always separate, whom we can pray to, whom we can love, whom we can receive grace from, but who's always separate. This is not true in Tantra. In Tantra, the divine is everywhere, omnipresent. Panentheism and Tantra are also different from what's called pantheism, which is often associated with indigenous religions like the Australian Aboriginal land religion and the Peruvian land mysticism, in which every rock and tree and clump of soil is understood to be sacred, but which is not, which does not agree or believe that it's flowing necessarily from a supreme spirit. And it's also, and this is really important for those of us who study Eastern traditions, it's also different from classical Advaita Vedanta and non-dual Buddhism, where the individual self, in Buddhism, the individual self is considered to be a fiction. And in both these traditions, the physical world is seen as an illusory superimposition on consciousness, consciousness being the only true reality. And by consciousness, what these traditions mean is the pure feeling of being, of awareness, with no object within it. Now, most of us here are non-dualists, and at least intellectually, but most of us, or actually I won't try to speak to all of you. I personally am very much a believer in the tantric view, which is very different from the view that attempts to disengage our sense of being from the objects of the world. You know, if you're familiar with Advaita Vedanta, you know that the kind of overall mantra in that tradition is neti neti. This body is not the truth. The breath is not the truth. The mind is not the truth. The thoughts are not the truth. The world is not the truth. None of this is the truth. What is the truth? What is true? Is that awareness which is present, which knows all this. In Tantra, the overall mantra is iti iti. All this, all this, all this, all this, all this. In other words, even though the world as we normally experience it as a separate entity, the illusion of separation is to be seen through. When that illusion is seen through, it's seen that spirit is in everything. One of my early kind of amazing eye-opening experiences, which happened back in the 70s when I was first walking this path, happened one evening when I was walking down Broadway. And Broadway in Upper Manhattan in the early and mid-70s was not the gentrified neighborhood it is today. This was way before Whole Foods. It was not a slum exactly, but a very run-down neighborhood. And the gutters were always full of trash and discarded syringes and old condoms and bottles, and it was not a pretty place. So I'm walking down the street. It's a normal Friday evening, and I suddenly become aware that the street and the gutters and the trash and the homeless man walking past me and, you know, the old decrepit Eastern European woman sitting on the bench in the middle of the median strip, that all of these not necessarily immediately attractive objects and people are filled with light and filled with beauty. They're literally sparkling with beauty. The eyes of the people I passed were full of love. The street itself seemed to undulate. This is what it is to awaken Shakti. It changes your vision so that you're able to see the light that interpenetrates matter. And even if that vision fades, there's something in it that you never forget. So in the Shaiva and Shakta tantric traditions, the source of all that is a single transcendent awareness. I'm going to give you the short form of tantric metaphysics. And I know that it's a review for many of you. And if it is a review for you, just let yourself, as you listen, feel the sort of amazing magnificence of this truth. So the source of all that is a single transcendent awareness, which has the nature of love, which is called Parashiva or Parashakti, supreme goodness or supreme power. And Parashiva is the ultimate reality, literally untouchable, unknowable, infinite, all-powerful. It's, you know, all the descriptions of transcendent divinity apply to Parashiva. But its main quality, according to the tantras, is absolute freedom. The Sanskrit word is Swatantriya, which means self-willed. That this ultimate reality, this consciousness, which is our source and which is in us in a condensed form, in a contracted form, it has the freedom to will or desire anything, the freedom to know anything, the freedom to do anything, to become anything. It is without limit. And its experience, the experience of Parashiva,
at inexpressibly subtle level is I am. I am. I am. And I find this very significant, obviously, because, you know, when Moses asks the burning bush, which was his projection of God, when God appears to him, because it's hard for him to see the divine as, or to experience the divine outside of the physical, he sees it as a flaming bush. And, you know, we all know this story, and he asks, what is this? And the bush, a voice comes out of the burning bush, which says, I am that I am. So this recognition is the recognition of the sages of all the traditions, that I am is being itself. And it has two inseparable aspects. One of them is called prakasha, which means light. That is the light that is the foundation of everything that is. This universe rests on a foundation of light. Not the kind of light we know in the physical world, but a light that is self-illuminating, that's infinitely subtle. And it has the quality that I'll call isness. Existingness, beingness, it simply is. The second quality of this vast awareness, of this beingness, is what gives it its freedom and power. And this second quality of the Absolute is called Vimarsha. Vimarsha is a hard word to describe, but it means something like feeling, knowing, the capacity for being self-aware. And these two qualities are fully present in their own consciousness. When you experience yourself as you most deeply are, what you experience is that you are light, you are being, you exist, and you know yourself to exist. And you feel yourself, you sense yourself in every state you're in. You know you're alive, and you know that you're experiencing yourself. So being and awareness are the intrinsic properties of divine consciousness and also of human consciousness. This vast light is self-recursive, meaning that it's always looking inward at its own being and experiencing blissful freedom as it appreciates itself. So that capacity for self-regard, self-knowing, is not some kind of obsessive narcissism. It's the source of our capacity for freedom, power, and activity. And when the tradition talks about Shakti, that's what it's talking about. Shakti is the self-awareness that which carries power and creativity of the source consciousness. Shiva, the prakasha aspect, is I without any object, pure I-ness. Shakti is the am, the capacity for experiencing it. And so Shiva, sometimes called the ground of being, it's a very, very common word to use for the heart of us, is essentially a disengaged witness, holding everything, the foundation of everything, but inactive. And, without the Vimarsha aspect, without the Shakti, the divine would have no power, and in which case, of course, it wouldn't be the divine. As one of the philosophers of Shaivism says, without Shakti, Shiva would be Shava, would be a corpse. And, of course, in several of the iconographic images of the divine couple, the goddess is shown seated or standing on the prone body of Shiva, indicating that she is the active principle in the universe, and also that she arises from Shiva. So it's very tempting, as a feminist, I'm often tempted to say, well, the feminine is the power in the cosmos. The feminine is the dominant. The feminine is the activity that, you know, is without the feminine, there would be no activity. But it's true. However, the truth is that at this level, there is no gender. Shiva and Shakti are not masculine and feminine. They're totally beyond all genders. And it's only when they begin to embody and form that polarities, including the masculine and feminine polarity, occur. We're going to do a brief meditation that hopefully will give you a sense of Prakasha Vimarsha. So once again, find your posture. And follow the breath. This practice that we're going to do is one that is probably going to be familiar to many of you. It is very much a foundational tantric practice, and it's one of the ways that we start to discover the presence of these two aspects of our consciousness, of our awareness. So as you focus on the breath, feeling the breath coming in, flowing in, and you want it to flow in very naturally, to flow in towards the heart. We're practicing very much with the heart tonight. Begin to become aware of the end of the exhalation. The breath flows in, flows into the heart. At a certain point, the exhalation arises and flows out of the body and comes to an end somewhere in the space in front of the body. See if you can become aware of that pause, that space at the end of the exhalation. I'm not going to ask you to hold your breath, but for some of you, if the pause is not revealing itself, it can be very helpful to hold the breath for one or two counts, 1 or 2 seconds. And just to start to be aware what you experience at the end of the exhalation. Perhaps you can notice that in those couple of seconds where the exhalation comes to an end, there is a kind of stillness in that thoughts are not arising. They will start to arise in a couple of minutes, but in these first moments when you're focused in the pause, there is a kind of stillness. Can you be aware of that? And can you be aware that there is also a pulsation? There's a kind of a throb. And this throb, which you might feel is the heartbeat, but as you become more and more aware of it, you realize that it's actually subtler than the heartbeat. So just let the breath flow in and out and linger for a few seconds in the pause at the end of the exhalation, sensing the quality of stillness, which defines it as a pause, as well as the dynamism, the pulsation, it's present there. See if you can let the breath come and go while you're
your focus is on that space between, that space at the end of the exhalation. What we begin to touch when we find these pause points between one form of natural activity and another, what we start to touch is the underlying consciousness, the underlying awareness that is actually the field out of which our life experience arises. And you know, as you, you know, those of you who meditate deeply know that as you go deeper into meditation, as you go past the thought streams, you come to this space where there is some stillness and there's also a sense of dynamism, of throbbing. There's also a sense of movement, which is the constant throb of the spanda of the shakti, which enlivens every aspect of life and which is an intrinsic part of what, for want of a better word, we call primordial consciousness or foundational consciousness. And, you know, I just want to say that the word consciousness is defined differently in different, by different disciplines. In neuroscience, consciousness is considered to be a epiphenomenon of the brain. It's considered to be an emergent property of the brain. Buddhism also considers consciousness to be a human quality. To the tantrika, the consciousness that we experience in our individuality is actually a holon, a microcosmic form that is a sliver or a slice of the absolute consciousness, and that as it expands, because the whole thing here is about the expansion of this spanda, as it expands, it begins to recognize itself as part of the larger consciousness, of the greater consciousness. And so in the grand narrative of Tantra, and these are the words of Abhinavagupta, all that exists is one infinite divine consciousness, free and blissful, which projects within its own field of awareness a multiplicity of apparently different subjects and objects. And that freedom of consciousness, we are going to attempt to learn to experience as our own consciousness, which is able to hold infinite thoughts, infinite feelings, and which also allows us to experience what we consider the outside world. And in the language of the tantric scriptures, it's said that when Shakti, when Shiva, the infinite light of awareness, gazes back at itself, remember we talked about Prakasha Vimarsha and the recursive gaze, when Shiva gazes at itself, it is called Shakti. And that single gesture of self-awareness is actually the source of all creativity for us. So, you know, when you meditate, when you do inquiry, even when you do the kind of inquiry, you know, that goes with psychotherapy, what you're doing is enacting the same self-recursive gesture of the Supreme Consciousness within your own consciousness. So inner-directed attention is always the tactic for coming in touch with your own greatest power. Learning how to turn your gaze backwards is the secret of true accomplishment and for transformation of personal power as well as self-knowledge.
And as Shakti recognizes herself, as Shiva Shakti does this glance of self-reflection, Shakti recognizes the power within her, and this automatic and completely natural desire arises. In Vedic texts, it's expressed like this. The Absolute regards itself and thinks, I am alone, let me become many. I am alone, let I am one, let me become many. In other words, let me make something. Let me express myself. Let me use my powers to do something creative. Let me manifest a fantasy. Let me manifest a world. And this world instantaneously comes into being inside the great mind, the great awareness of Shakti. And, so her creative impulse is the creative impulse of life, and we're going to see it manifest throughout the entire natural world. As one simple mundane example, last month we cut down several trees around my house in preparation for California's fire season. And now, 6 weeks later, the stumps are sprouting leaves, and they're pretty tall. They're about 8 inches tall. In other words, the unstoppable growth energy that's the most primordial expression of life is revealing itself in the branches coming out of the tree trunk. And we see this in every single realm of experience. So, but in order to become all this, Shakti has to contract her sense of self. And she does this through her power to measure, her power to conceal, which is called Maya. And her Maya draws a veil of separation between herself and her, between her Vimarsha self and her Prakasha self, between her Shakti self and her Shiva self. And this is the fundamental separation, which becomes more and more set in stone, as it were, as the process of manifestation occurs. So what Shakti does, she separates herself from the wholeness, and then she condenses herself. She becomes thicker and thicker and thicker until she ends up as the physical world and our physical self. And she does this through a series of stations, of stages, which are called tattvas. The word tattva comes from the word that, which means that. Tattva is the essence of something. It's the essence of a level of consciousness. And, again, all the traditions talk about a kind of hierarchy of consciousness, starting from the infinitely subtle and ending up as something much more thick and dense and gross. One of the things that the tantric texts tell us is that in the highest levels of the tattvas, in the higher reaches of the tattvas, that this is where the beings whom we call deities reside. In other words, deity forms are not the absolute, which is formless and beyond everything. Deity forms come into being as Shakti is condensing herself. And these deity forms become functionaries with kind of cosmic work that they perform. And the most significant of these beings are the ones that we contact in order to receive grace. For some of us, that person, that being is a teacher. For some, it's an archetype of the Guru principle, like Buddha or Christ. Sometimes it's an actual deity form, and sometimes that grace-bestowing entity is experienced in a much more abstract way, as you know, as what mystical Christianity calls the Christ light. The point is that in these higher tattvas, there are beings who experience themselves as separate creatures, much, 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 much more expansive, much, much more powerful than the rest of us, and also perfectly aware of non-duality. So in other words, these beings at the highest levels of consciousness are the beings that in some traditions are called Godhead. And in the tantric traditions and in Vedanta and in the yoga tradition, these beings are called Ishwara or Ishwari. Ishwara means ruler. But in fact, Ishwara is a state. It's an energy that both lives beyond the world and is also seated within the heart. So Ishwara is the personal deity, the God being of the theists, and does not have a single form. So one of the reasons that in the Indian tradition, there's so much comfort with the understanding that the absolute reality is this vast, formless, transcendent spaciousness, if you will, but also can manifest through individual beings. One of the reasons that the Indian tradition is so comfortable holding this simultaneous recognition that of the absolute non-duality and also of the existence of higher beings with powers that we can definitely call God powers, is because of this understanding about the tattvas, about the higher levels of consciousness. And if you're a follower of a Shaiva sect, you would call Ishwara Shiva. If you're a follower of Vishnu, you would call Ishwara Vishnu or Rama or Krishna. If you're a Christian, you would call Ishwara Jehovah. And if you're a Shakta, a lover of the goddess, you would call Ishwara Kali or Durga or Lalita Tripura Sundari or Lakshmi. And the experience of personal deity, of Ishwara, is total awareness of its own being as a personal being, along with the awareness that the universe lives within its own body. Even though we feel most of the time that what we're praying to when we pray to a God figure, which I know many of you do, is that we're praying to something separate and outside ourselves, the fact is that we're actually praying to a higher octave of ourselves who is utterly present in our being. And it's one of the reasons why in the Yoga Sutras, you know, many of you were studied with me in the class on the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, that there's a very famous verse, which verse 34 of the first book of the Yoga Sutra, which talks about Ishwara, the being, the personal deity within the heart. So this understanding that in the midst of all this formlessness, there are forms that, you know, that give grace to us and that are actually with whom we can have a devotional personal relationship, but which are also aspects of our own self. It's a tremendous paradox that Tantra is very, very good at helping us understand that deity is separate enough from us that we can love her, and that she's also completely present in the heart, and that she's also beyond all of this. So let's just take a moment to practice of the mantra, and then we'll start our Navaratri celebration of goddess worship, goddess devotion. So as we were doing earlier, close your eyes, find yourself in a comfortable upright position, let the sits bones deeply ground into the seat. Let the spinal column rise up through the ceiling, through the crown. And let the breath begin to flow in and out of the heart. Imagine once again that you're seated in front of the sacred fire in this open-sided temple where all of us are celebrating the first night of Shivaratri. We're celebrating Shakti as Goddess Durga, as the goddess who's also known as Chandi, who's also a form of Kali. And as we inhale, we feel rising from the flames, Om Rim Shvim Dum Durgaye Namaha. We breathe this in, offering it into Durga in the heart, Durga who is the form of Ishwari in the heart. You don't have to imagine her with the form. You just have to have the feeling that she's present. And allow the mantra to flow in with the breath as an offering to this presence in the heart, to Shakti, to Durga, to the goddess within the field of your own heart. Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Rim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Rim Shrim Dum Durgaye Namaha. I want to read you two of the translations of two of the hymns from the Chandipat, the Durga Saptashati. Salutations to you, who is intent on rescuing the distressed and afflicted who surrender to you. Salutations to you, who removes the suffering of all. And another one, salutations to you, who when pleased destroys all afflictions, when displeased thwarts all aspirations. No calamity befalls those who've taken refuge in you. One who seeks refuge in you becomes a refuge for others. So this is what we're doing, is what we're about here. We're seeking refuge in Durga, in the heart. And I want to say something about the wording of this, of these mantras. This text, these texts come from the medieval tradition, and they're full of very intense language. And I know that for many of us, the idea of pleasing or displeasing a deity is kind of problematic. It reminds us of being a small child, of being helpless, and you know, of the very painful and frustrating experience of not being approved of and you know, that feeling of not being approved of is, you know, kind of a lifelong issue for many people. So let's look at the esoteric implications of this, because it's not about whether the goddess approves of you or disapproves of you. What it means, when it refers to the goddess's displeasure, this verse is talking about the alienation and discomfort we experience when we become disconnected from our own Shakti. So to please the goddess is to recognize her as the one who is living our lives. That's what really pleases the goddess. And what displeases the goddess is not allowing ourselves to feel her presence. You know, so when it says that when displeased, she thwarts all aspirations, what this verse is referring to is something that all of us experience from time to time, which is the incredible frustration of trying to accomplish something on our own as individuals and just having it not work. So the secret of refuge, the secret of surrender to the goddess, and it's really one of the great tantric promises, is that if you really offer yourself to her, if you really can believe that it's she who's breathing your breath, it's she who's making your heart beat, it's she who's acting through you, that you can turn to her and she will accomplish whatever you have to accomplish. I can tell you this from experience. You know, according to your nature, to your talents, to your skills, you know, to what you want, in recognizing and invoking the presence of the goddess, she will blossom you. She will make you flower. And if you can't recognize her presence, then, you know, you're in that situation of so many of us where you just can't make something happen. So the great metaphor that's given, especially in discussions of the Navaratri process, for the relationship of the seeker or devotee to the goddess, is the relationship of the child to the mother. And, you know, there are other ways of relating to the goddess. You can relate to her pretty much in any way you feel comfortable. But in this, you know, in understanding the arc of our sadhana and the arc of our practice, it's a very lovely to look at this metaphor. You know, what is said is that the goddess is like the mother, you know, who sends you out to play when you're like 10 years old. And back in the day when I was growing up, you could play in the neighborhood and, you know, you would go out in the morning, you would hang out with your friends, you would make forts, you would have play fights, you would do whatever you did. And then at lunchtime, you'd be called back to the house. And, you know, this is the metaphor for sadhana. It's like the Divine Mother, Shakti, sends us forth into the world. And then at a certain point, she calls us home. And when she calls us home, what she's actually doing is calling us back to her heart, not only for refuge in our normal mundane life, but also to offer us the possibility of self-recognition, of recognizing ourselves as part of her. We become true human beings when we realize that we're living inside the mother. When we realize that you're never disconnected from her. The story of Durga is embedded in another story, and I'm going to give it to you very briefly. The story is that a great king, his name was Sudrata, which means chariot, was in a very bad situation. He'd been defeated by his enemies, been exiled from his kingdom, and he goes to the ashram of a sage named Medha, where he meets another person who's taking refuge there, who's a merchant, who's also lost everything. His relatives have cheated him out of his fortune. He's lost his family. He's been kicked out of his house. And the king and the merchant get to talking.
And they both realize that they cannot stop obsessing about their old life, despite the fact that it's gone, despite the fact that it's time for them to move on, despite the fact that they're in the ashram of the sage. Their minds keep going back again and again to what they've lost, how much they resent it, what victims they are of their circumstances, how much suffering their families and the opposing armies have cost them. They ask the sage, so why are we so stuck in the past? Why can't we just forget it? The sage says, ah, this is the question that human beings have been asking forever. You know, an enchantment, a delusion covers the minds of every being, which draws him again and again to things that cause suffering. And then he goes into a long explanation of Maya, the deluding power who creates this universe of diversity, hides herself in the midst of it, and makes us believe that pleasure and happiness is only to be found in the drama of this ever-changing world. So the sage points out that because the goddess is everything, both the deluding power and the liberating power, that she's therefore the only source of refuge. So he tells us, you lie in the arms of the great mother as a child lies in the arms of a human mother. And the more you realize that behind everything that appears as this world is her love, the more our lives are supported by her, and the more we're able to surf the waves of reality. Ramakrishna, the great lover of the goddess, used to pray, O Mother, please hide your face as delusion and separation, and show me your face as liberation. So, you know, he understood this quality, that the goddess is both and. She's suffering and she's joy. She's bondage and she's liberation. She's confusion and she's wisdom. She's ignorance and she's knowledge. So, and what that means, practically speaking, is that she lives in us. Not only as our inner self and not only as our beautiful qualities, but also as all the qualities that tend us towards bondage. So our desire for freedom and our desire for stuff are both aspects of the goddess. They live in our mind. They live in our intellect. They live in our heart. And, you know, most of you here are a mixture of what the texts call binding and tendencies and liberating tendencies. Because you're sadhakas, because you're practitioners, your liberating tendencies, your desires and samskaras of expansion, of liberation, of unity consciousness, will often outweigh the resistance and the emotional upheaval and the limiting beliefs that make up your binding tendencies. But we all live in this mixture of qualities, and we never know when one of the binding tendencies is going to show up. So, and I'm going to ask you this week during the homework assignment to actually start to look at these, because a lot of what the Navaratri celebration is about is beginning to offer your binding tendencies. You know, for instance, if you look carefully at your attitudes, you might recognize that you're living with the assumption that spiritual life is what you do when you're at your altar or on your yoga mat or reading a spiritual text, and that as soon as you get up, as soon as you put down the book, as soon as you go back to your work or your family, you know, or trying to deal with your bills, that all this is mundane, it's worldly, that it's not part of your spiritual life. So in other words, we're living in an unconscious duality between our spiritual self and our worldly self. And so in extreme cases, when we make the separation between the spiritual and the worldly,
we come to believe that we actually have to leave the world in order to be spiritual. And we, you know, we get so deeply confused by our obligations that we can't see that Shakti is operating as those obligations. So those are all symptoms of the duality of Maya, that as it lives inside our mind and intellect. You know, so it's very interesting to look at what are the beliefs that keep us stuck and what are the beliefs that liberate us. So it's, you know, one of the things I'd like you to look at is the degree to which you believe on some core level that only what you experience with your senses is real, or that regurgitates a narrative of your victimhood or your incapacity or your inefficiency or insufficiency, or, you know, the way in which it's so easy to fall into fear and anger about so many of the things that are going on in society. To look at how those experiences are binding you, and to look at how a slight shift of attitude, not inaction, not leaving the world, but a slight shift of attitude will put you in touch with your liberated intellect, your liberated mind, your liberated heart, which can either be, you know, to give an extreme example, which can be inundated with sadness and resentment, which can also be a channel for wisdom and empathy. And these things all exist together. So in the process of Navaratri celebration, we're actually asking the goddess to remove these veils, to clear out all this, to take away the binding qualities, and to show us the essential liberating qualities. So the festival of Navaratri is generally divided into 9 days, and in many of the traditional interpretations, each of these 9 days is dedicated to one of the forms of Durga, one of the 9 Durgas, and there are different aspects, different faces with different names of the goddess Durga. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see that I'm posting little statements about them every day of Navaratri. But the way I want to look at Navaratri here, and the way I generally celebrate it, is in 3 parts, each of which is meant to bring you into intimate contact with one of the 3 main forms of the goddess that most of us recognize. The first 3 days are dedicated to Kali and to the tapas, the intense energy that's necessary to destroy the grosser aspects of our negative ego. And this process takes place in consciousness at whatever level is up for you at this time in your life. It's one way, 1 year, it's another way, another year. You know, for me, sometimes the Kali days of Navaratri celebration are just incredibly emotionally volatile, filled with upheavals. And then there are days when, you know, there are festivals where I'll get a cold or a sore throat. And what it often feels like is that you're just being tossed around in a kind of a washing machine of purification. And then when those 3 days are done, you realize that somehow you've been cleaned out. And in the second 3 days of Navaratri, the goddess Lakshmi, who offers abundance and love and wealth, begins to come to the surface. And in us as sadhakas, the presence of Lakshmi often it gives us the experience of being in touch with our most beautiful essential qualities. You know, our fearlessness, our sweetness, our capacity for kindness, which are, we could say, expressions of Goddess Lakshmi. Right now, we're in the Kali part, and you know, we're experiencing the purification of the most primitive parts of ourselves. This is what Kali, this is what the 3 days of the Kali aspect of the celebration is really about. It's the first 3 days of Navaratri essentially are about cleaning out your lizard brain. You know, that part of you that's kind of mindlessly fearful, reactive, at the mercy of your most primitive impulses. Exoterically, in some parts of India, the purificatory process of the festival includes animal sacrifice, actually physical sacrifice of a goat, sometimes a buffalo. But the real animal sacrifice, the true animal sacrifice, is not external. It actually is the sacrifice of your tendencies like inertia, resistance, stubbornness, feelings of hopelessness and depression. So in other words, it's cleaning out the detritus in the brainstem. You know, most of our diseases, as many of you know, especially chronic diseases, are caused by stress. And much of that stress comes from unprocessed childhood trauma, which is stored in the brainstem and in also in the amygdala, in the limbic system. As Kali's Shakti clears out these parts of the brain, she liberates the qualities that are being occluded, that are being distorted by this accumulated karmic detritus. She takes it out of the brain, and we can help by practicing relaxation with the body. Of course, Kali's ultimate boon is the removal of the veil that keeps you from seeing that you're non-dual, that you're not separate from the divine. During these Kali days, you could experience complete liberation. The second 3 days, the days of Lakshmi, which are dedicated to all the forces of auspiciousness and abundance and wealth and pleasure and success, fulfillment of your worldly goals, there is also a battle. You know, the legends, the mythology of Navaratri is, it's a battle story. It's a story of three battles with three types of demons. And the demons of the Kali period are very, very primitive. They're known as dirt demons. They're the forms of gross uncleanliness that kind of wrap us around. They're tamasic. Whereas when we come to the Lakshmi battle, the Lakshmi battle is a battle with a demon who is an animal, but who is characterized by his incredible attachment to wealth and power. So the Shakti of Lakshmi, like all Shaktis, has an enlightened aspect, and she also has a shadow aspect, because, of course, goddesses are everything, so they are both light and shadow. And the shadow of Lakshmi is a shadow of power for its own sake, wealth for its own sake, and, you know, which can be expressed in negative and sometimes even psychotic ways. And the demon who is battled in the second set of verses of the Durga Saptashati is a demon called Mahisha, Mahisha Sura. Mahisha means buffalo. So he's an asura, a demon, who has the form of a buffalo. And his energy is the energy that you see in violent kleptocratic dictators, people like Idi Amin or Stalin or some of our contemporary dictators and politicians. It's pretty easy to see these guys in the outer world. They appall us. What's not so easy to see is how that energy can live in us, in each of us, as obsessive desire and resentment. The desire to
take everything, to, you know, to strike out. Often it's unprocessed, and it's an interesting fact that in the age of peak TV, a lot of the, so to speak, prestige TV shows like The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or Billions actually celebrate this level of intense, ruthless greed and desire for power. So I think it one of the reasons that we watch these shows is because it allows us to in some way process this Mahisha energy. So the story goes, Mahisha, this buffalo, wants to rule the world. So he does tapas, difficult austerities, praying to Brahma, the creator, to become invincible. And finally, his tapas succeeds. Brahma appears to him and asks him what boon he wants. And Mahishasura asks for the boon that he not be able to be killed by any man, any god, or any demon. So Brahma, of course, agrees. And from this boon, Mahisha he rouses a huge army of demons, really fierce and terrible demons, and together they defeat the gods, they defeat all the human rulers, they move into the heaven of the gods, and in the meantime, the gods are all clustered in caves and dark places of the earth, completely defeated and completely upset and frustrated, and to top it off, because these demonic forces are ruling the world is becoming more and more difficult, painful, unrighteous. You know, the spiritual practice, such as it is done only for the sake of gain, personal gain. The crops are, you know, there's drought, there's terrible water shortages, there are fires, there are floods, yes, there's things going on in the world that we might recognize. And finally, the gods, not only for their own sake, but also for the sake of the world, go to Vishnu and they beg to be given some way of changing the situation. So what Vishnu says to them, of course, you know this story, is, well, there's a loophole in this boon because Mahisha asks to be protected from being killed by any man, god, or a demon, but he didn't mention a woman. What you have to do is pray to the goddess and ask her for help. And that, of course, is what the gods do. Most of the hymns many of the hymns in the Chandipat are hymns that the gods sing to the goddess. And after they've prayed, she comes to them as a blazing pillar of fire, a blinding light. And appearing in that light, she agrees to help the gods. And what they then do is offer her all of their personal shakti embodied in their weapons. So when the goddess takes form, she's the most beautiful woman the world has ever seen. She has 18 arms, which hold Shiva's trident, Agni's fireball, Vishnu's chakra and mace, all the weapons of the gods. And she also holds all the shakti of the gods, which, you know, in the Shakta tradition, it's said that the goddess, the primordial shakti, gives power to all beings and especially power to the gods. So what they're doing is giving her back the power that she's lent them. And with all this, she lets out a mighty roar, a terrible roar, which makes the heavens shake and the oceans, you know, she brings up tsunamis and earthquakes. Mahisha, in his heavenly abode, hears the roar. He says, "What's that? What's that? Who's roaring like that? Find out who's making this horrible noise. Bring him to me so I can drink his blood."
So he sends his scouts out to find out what's going on, and they immediately are brought into the presence of the Devi, who's shining like the sun, bedecked in diamonds and flower garlands with all her weapons, and drinking cup after cup of wine, which is the wine of primordial ecstasy. And they're like flabbergasted. So they run back to Mahisha and they say, we've just seen the most beautiful woman in the world arrayed for battle. And this news excites Mahisha like nothing he's ever heard. He goes, oh my God, this is the woman of my dreams. This is my chosen consort. This is a woman who's actually strong enough to be my queen. So he tells his generals, go and persuade her to come to my palace and bring her gifts, flatter her, and if none of that works, then bring her by force, but don't hurt her. The generals go to the Devi, and when she hears the message, she throws back her head and she laughs. She says, you don't know who I am. I am the goddess, and I've come to kill you all. So here's my message to your master. If you want to live, give up the kingdom of the gods and go back to the underworld. So the generals go back and they find a tactful way to give this message. And Mahisha keeps sending more and more messengers, more and more generals. Finally, you know, when she's refused him 5 or 6 times, he calls his council. She says, she really means it? She really want to kill me? And the council say, no. It's just a form of flirtation. You know, she's being arrogant. But like all women, she's saying the opposite of what she really feels. She wants you. And so when she says she'll take your life, she means she'll take the seed from your loins when you make love to her. You know, she's inviting you. She knows that you're a warrior and that you know, warlike talk will excite you, but what she really wants is the sexual battle. So Mahisha keeps sending generals and she keeps killing them, and much of this poem is about the violent means with which the Devi kills all these demon armies. Finally, he himself goes to meet her. And the thing is, he's so infatuated with her. He's so in love with her. And this is a theme in devotional literature. You know, the enemy of the divine is actually obsessed with the divine. He's in love with her. And he's so excited that he's finally going to see her. So, you know, he's fantasizing about what it would be like to have her in his bed. And he thinks, well, she'll be scared of my buffalo form. So he clothes himself in the form of a handsome prince, which of course the goddess immediately sees through. He says, beautiful lady, if you'll be mine, I will do whatever you ask. I'll even give up my kingdom if you'll be my wife. And the goddess gives one of those incredible laughs filled with beauty and menace. And why would I want you, she asks. There's no pleasure you can give me. I am bliss itself. And you're destroying the Dharma. So I've taken this form to eliminate you. And the only way you're going to touch me is when I kill you. So, and there's the final battle. And you can imagine how this battle goes. Magical fire arrows, poison-tipped spears. Mahisha keeps changing shape. He becomes a lion, then he becomes an elephant, then he becomes a terrible bird, like the ego itself, which has infinite shapes. He tries everything. And finally, he stands before her in his original form as a raging buffalo. So just consider, Mahisha represents the primitive aspects of your ego, which disguise themselves in all kinds of ways, but there comes a moment when you actually see what it is and what it's doing to you. And by ego here, of course, we're talking about that aspect of our individuation, which wants to stand alone, which never wants to surrender
to the actual living flow of grace that will allow us to know what we truly are. So this is the ego as every form of resistance and stubbornness and false pride. And at that moment, when Mahisha stands before her as his self, the goddess roars, shaking the worlds, takes up the spinning discus, holding it on her finger, says, "Here is your death," sends it spinning out across the cosmos, where it takes off Mahisha's head. He falls like a tree and dissolves into her feet, becoming one with her. And the story goes on to say that from that moment, a golden age dawns on Earth, when love and harmony prevails in society, when crops grow tall, when people think kind thoughts of each other, and everyone works together for the good of the world. Eventually, of course, another set of demons will be born, and they will be part of the story of the third three nights of Navaratri. But in this moment, in the moment of the Devi's victory, all of us can experience this world as it's meant to be, which is as literally a paradise, a place of love, a place of creativity, a place of profound goodness. So, as we bring our practice to an end for now, just know that you'll be getting homework, which will include meditations, it'll include some contemplations, and it will include some mantras that by chanting which you'll be able to get more and more in touch with the grace-bestowing power of Navaratri and of the goddess herself. And I want to say about these stories, you know, they're violent stories. They sound like Marvel comic books or movies from the Marvel Universe. And for many of us, because many of you here are quite psychologically evolved, and one of the things that we understand is that even though when it comes to dealing with dictators in the outer world, violences and war are often necessary, that when dealing with the dictators in the inner world, one of the things we've learned post-Jung is that rather than fighting these tendencies, we can actually learn how to integrate them, how to see them for what they are, discover how the parts of us that are not acceptable to our higher self can actually be owned and can begin to reveal that they have their own divine purpose when they're clarified. There's great power in this. But it's also true that when it comes to the deeply rooted tendencies that drive us to act against the interests of the soul, it takes an intense effort to uproot them. Kind of like pulling up a weed by its roots. It's, you know, before the ego merges in the goddess, it will oppose her right up to the last moment. So there are times, and there will be times, when the higher, more evolved parts of the self are defeated by these tendencies, which can be as obvious as an addiction or an abusive relationship, or as subtle as a desire to be praised by everyone you know, or as the feeling that you're inadequate or insufficient or not a good person. All of these are profoundly obstructive tendencies. And the point that these stories make is that we need to see into and be willing to uproot these qualities. The ones that seem you know, powerful, like pride and stubbornness, and the ones that seem weak, like self-deprecation and self-distrust. Because in our core, a human being carries the creative freedom of the Shakti, our bodies and minds constantly act out that freedom. So the choices we make, moment to moment, you know, there's that famous Native American saying about the two wolves that live with us and how we can choose to feed the wolf of negativity or the positive wolf. Well, that's really what the choices of sadhana are about. It's the accumulation of negative and self-deluding choices that keep us moving in the wheel of suffering. And yet for all of us, there are these moments when we see through the illusions we've been living by, when we catch a glimpse of what's in our heart, when we see the beauty in another person, when we feel the desire to know the truth, or when we catch a glimpse of how our tendencies are hurting us. And in those moments, we choose the path of liberation. We put our heads at the goddess's feet and we ask that they be removed. So, and it, you know, the way we do this may be to pray, or it might be to turn back and really hold a negative tendency in awareness and let awareness dissolve it. But every one of those moments when we choose to turn towards liberation, when we choose to open to the goddess in her grace-bestowing form, when we let go of our resistance to our own greatness, as well as our resistance to seeing what holds us back, in every one of those moments, the goddess is with us 100%, you know, 1,000%. You know, in my experience, different strategies for working with your deluded mind are important at different times. And much of the time, the way we work with our deluded mind or our negativities, you know, are through meditation or through holding space or through offering a mantra. You know, there are many, many methods. But what I've found is that when I'm truly overwhelmed by negativities, when I'm truly confused, that that's the time to throw myself at the goddess's feet and beg her to transform the particles of your psyche. And that's what Navaratri is about. That's why it's so auspicious to be turning the wheel of Shakti at this time of year. So Navaratri, then, is a celebration of the meeting of human aspiration and divine grace. We're going to end with the mantra. I want to encourage you to spend time during these weeks, during this week, to take refuge in Durga, in the remover of obstacles. And for now, you can allow the breath to flow in and out of your heart. To feel the presence of the Divine Mother surrounding you and rising up from within you. And allow each breath to flow into the heart with Om Hrim Shrim Dum Durgaya Namaha. Let yourself breathe the mantra which celebrates the infinite, her power of manifestation, her supreme auspiciousness, and her willingness to remove every obstacle that stands between you and your inner truth. Let yourself take refuge in the mantra, which is the form of the goddess Durga, which is the form through which we connect ourselves to the energy of protection and liberation. Shreem Dum Durgaya Namaha. Om Hrim Shreem Dum Durgaya Namaha. Just sit for a few moments and meditate on her liberating presence. Thank you so much.
Om Namah Chandikaya. Om Namah Chandikaya. Om Namah Chandikaya. Jayanti Mangala Kali. Badrakali Kapalini. Durga Kshama Shivadatri. Swaha Swadhanamostute. Jayatvam Devi Chamande. Jaya Bhutartya. Jaya Sarvagate Devi Kalaratri Namostute Madukai Tabam Vidravi Vidatri Varade Namaha Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jayi Mahishasura Nirnashi Bhaktanam Sukade Namaha Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jayi Shambhasya Eva Shambhasya Dhumrakshasya Chamadini Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Natevyah Sarvadha Bhaktya Chandike Durita Pahe Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Dehi Sobhagyam Arogyam Dehi Me Paramasukam Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jayi Videhi Devi Kalyanam Videhi Paramam Shriyam Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jayi Himachala Sudana Samstute Parameshwari Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jayi Indrani Pati सद्भावं पूजिते परमेश्वरि रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि कृशो देहि देवि प्रचण्ड दरदण्ड दैत्य दर्प विनाशिनी रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो देहि पत्नी मनोरमा देहि मनोवृतानु सारणि तारणीं दुर्गा संसार सागरस्य कलोपम रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो Rupam de Jaya.